This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. When we hear about dangerous emissions from coal-fired power plants, we often hear about mercury, ozone or smog, greenhouse gases. But what about lead? A new study from West Virginia University finds that lead poisoning in vultures is much more prevalent than expected. Researchers say the source of the lead is coming from ammunition and power plant emissions. And as Glennis Board found out, if it's in vultures, it's a danger to humans as well.
So actually, all these birds out here are representatives of birds that we would typically test for lead exposure, although not all of them have had it. This is a common raven.
Doctor of veterinary medicine Jesse Fallon is passing in front of outdoor bird enclosures that house injured, rescued wild birds, a raven, a black vulture, a bald eagle. They're powerful and smart birds, but they all shift about when Fallon comes around. He's the doctor who operates on them, tests their blood for lead, and administers medicine. Fallon is the director of veterinary medicine for the Avian Conservation Center of Appalachia, which is a nonprofit that treats and rehabilitates injured, ill, or orphaned wild birds. Through his work and ecotoxicology training, Fallon has become an expert on lead poisoning.
I take care of a lot of wild birds, and each year we admit a number of birds who present for lead toxicity specifically. Lead is a natural element. It's found in the environment, and in biological systems, it really has no meaningful role. We've known for centuries that lead is a toxin, and it's dangerous to animals and humans.
Fallon explains that even low levels of exposure can wreak havoc through the body, neurologically, in tissue and organs, and impairing reproductive abilities. He explains that lead can cause anemia, a neurological injury which can lead to blindness, seizures, weakness, and even death. Fallon says this is certainly true for birds, but also for humans, especially children who are developing a nervous system. The Centers for Disease Control reported that at least 4 million households today have children living in them that are being exposed to high levels of lead. CDC says no safe blood level in children has been identified. And since lead can affect nearly every system in the body and leave no obvious symptoms, it frequently goes unrecognized. In a recent report, the CDC wrote that compelling evidence shows that low levels of exposure are associated with IQ deficits, attention-related behaviors, and poor academic achievement. That's why a new study out of West Virginia University that identifies chronic lead exposure in scavenging birds from this region is kind of troubling. Fallon was in on the study. He helped researchers understand the physiological ramifications of lead exposure and how lead moves through the body and where to look for it.
Bone acts as a sink for lead. It is something of a protective mechanism for the neural tissue. Blood that has elevated lead concentrations, that lead is sequestered in the bone and built into the bone matrix, and that reduces the lead concentration in the bloodstream, but it can last for long periods of time, for years, in the bone.
So for this study, Shannon Bemke cut into the femur bones of just over 100 vulture carcasses to look for lead.
Reading more of the literature, I understood that probably most of these vultures would have lead exposure or signs of lead exposure within their organs, but the extent to which we found it within the femurs was incredible.
Bemke, the lead author of the study, found evidence of significant lead exposure in every bone she examined, which indicates persistent exposure throughout the birds' lives. Vultures typically live about 10 years, so this study is an indicator of environmental exposures over the last decade. But that's not all she was able to determine.
So we did isotope ratio analysis, and it pretty much gives ideas of where the sources could be of this lead. And what we found were isotope ratios similar to those found in lead ammunition and also lead emissions from coal-fired power plants.
There were a couple of other sources, and isotope ratio analysis of lead is an inexact science. But Bemke says ammunition and coal-fired power plants seem to be the major sources of lead.
The presence of lead in these vultures is indicative of a potential potential threat that humans face.
Bemke's thesis advisor and wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, Todd Katzner.
We view these vultures as indicators, as canaries in the coal mine.
Katzner points out that vultures are obviously breathing the emissions that we breathe. In 2005, West Virginia had coal-fired generating units at 20 locations. Three have been retired, and American Electric Power says three more are supposed to go offline next month. Katzner also says it's important to think about lead ammunition, especially in a state that harvested about 40,000 bucks during last year's firearm season alone. Vultures often eat discarded gut piles. Most of those animals were killed with lead ammunition. Since that lead is making its way into the birds, Katzner says chances are it's also probably making its way onto our tables. And remember, even low levels of lead are dangerous. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:50. Rain and thunderstorms in the forecast today. Temperatures in the 60s and low 70s. Rain and thunderstorms tonight, tomorrow, Wednesday night, and into Thursday.
Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by the High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia. Online at WVHTF.org.
NPR is seeking to open itself up to new voices. That's not a call for auditioning new newscasters. Rather, NPR is looking for more diversity in its programs, stories, and the people interviewed for those stories. And what's more, NPR is turning to local public radio stations to teach us how to bring more diverse voices into our news. NPR recently sent its diversity team to us here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Keith Woods is NPR's Vice President of Diversity in News and Operations. Luis Clemens is Senior Editor of Diversity. What is NPR's view of diversity?
Well, I think if I were going to speak about it in those broad terms, the notion is that diversity, first of all, takes a lot of forms. Everything from race and ethnicity to sexual orientation, gender, class, ideology, a number of categories. And it is not a state of being. It is not a set of categories. It is action. So that diversity means doing things to actively include, actively expand, actively engage people and ideas that are not a regular part currently of the portfolio of NPR's work. It also means to achieve that we are actively pursuing a broader mix of people to work at NPR, and it means that we are constantly pursuing a broader audience to engage with.
Mm-hmm. Luis, anything to add to that?
Well, I'd say stories, too. We want to make sure that we're telling stories broadly that represent the country at large.
Why did this come up? What made NPR take a look at itself and say, you know, we're not diverse enough?
You know, NPR probably more than most news organizations I know, and I have worked with dozens of them over the last 20 years, has a history of work in diversity that goes back many, many, many years. And in fact, in the founding document of the organization, the idea of diversity more than 40 years ago resides. So it isn't a new idea. We didn't just decide to do it recently. NPR has had a lot of these kinds of efforts that began at the ground level, but died because of lack of accountability and organizational support.
So the two of you are going around the country, talking with us locals at local public radio stations about diversity. What's your message to us? What would you like from us?
I think what we want from each of the stations that we visit is a serious commitment to covering the breadth and depth of your community. And doing so at a local level means that you can feed into the network, into the national newscasts and news magazines, stories that deeply reflect not the surface, not the stereotypes of your given community, but something that really reflects who you are and that reflects that identity of each individual station.
Yeah, and I think that the sort of epiphany a ways back at NPR around the issue of diversity is that we can't ever accomplish alone what needs to be accomplished at NPR. That the voice of NPR, what is to the average person in the average town in this country, is so totally blended with the voice of the local station that what NPR is always going to be the collective voice of the station and the network. So it is in all of our best interest to work together on this, to have a single conversation around it that understands what we're trying to achieve. Because when we've done that, as Luis says, not only do we benefit as a whole from it, but we're able to learn something from you that we can take to the next station. Mm-hmm. In that sense, build a collective knowledge around what works, what needs to be done, what's possible, and what's been achieved.
It is perceived that NPR, and therefore local public radio stations, are liberal. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the categories have always been troublesome, and they are more freighted today with meaning beyond the core definition of those words than they've ever been. So it's hard to say yay or nay to a term like liberal when it can range from some people's definition of mindless adherence to a particular political ideology, mm-hmm. To something as simple as believing, which is at the core of what I would regard as many liberal thinkers, that that there are some things that are clearly right and wrong, and that you stand up for the voiceless, that you hold the powerful accountable, that there are many of these values that are assigned to liberal that I would embrace, because that's what is at the core of any good news organization, and we are good.
Luis, how do you handle that issue? NPR is too liberal.
So I'm an editor, right? I work on individual pieces. And my goal at all times is to be fair to the truth. You know, some truths are, some truths require a range of viewpoints to help listeners achieve, make their own decisions. But I think it's important to not let things that you know to be false go uncontested. I'll give an example. Recently, we were editing a story about SeaWorld. SeaWorld has a new CEO. SeaWorld has a new ad campaign. And in their ad campaign, they talk about there's an independent study that shows that orcas living in captivity live just as long as or longer than those who are in the wild. Well, that's accurate, but it's incomplete because it's not at all surprising that animals who get the benefit of veterinary care, mm-hmm. it's not surprising that they should live the same. So unless you come out and add that little piece of information that says, okay, they've said something that is true, but it's also something that is irrelevant. You never want to be in the position of misleading your listener. You want to be fair to the truth. And when you're talking about editing one story after another, day in, day out, you're looking to be fair to the truth.
Luis Clemens, Keith Woods, NPR's diversity team, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It's good to be here.
You can listen to a longer interview with NPR's diversity team on our website, wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Follow us on Twitter at WV Public News and find us on Facebook. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.